Welcome, welcome, welcome to Jerry Roach's podcast. In the previous episode, we climbed Denali, the Great One, back in 1963. An interesting factoid is that I then had climbed Denali before I had climbed Rainier. So, obviously, we had to take care of that problem. So, in 1964, Rainier needed to happen. So, in this episode, in two parts, we're going to cover Chapter 2 from my book Northern Heights, Climbing North America's Highest Peaks. Das Cave, Rainier, 1964. The Color of the Mountain. On the rare days when the rainy coastal weather clears, you can see Mount Rainier's striking slopes from Seattle, and locals spread the joy on such glorious days by saying, "The mountain is out!" Rainier is so impressive that a broad fountain-featuring corridor on the University of Washington campus purposely points at it. As I walked to my math class, I made my daily stop at the top of the Rainier Vista corridor to check. But as usual, clouds obscured everything except the campus buildings. Entering class, I picked a desk by the window, since even if the classroom faced the wrong way, I could still keep track of the weather. It was late May. A grueling year of classes was almost over, and I was twitching to be outside. As I leaned toward the glass, the old chair I was sitting in, which was reminiscent of the old milk truck navigator chair, squeaked beyond its normal snick, letting out a large snark. The professor shot me a knowing glance, then started his math lecture. My body felt trapped in this classroom, but my mind was still free. So I propped my elbow on the windowsill and let my mind wander across an imaginary glacier. My heavy class schedule caught up with me. I fell sound asleep and had a short but vivid dream about falling into a crevasse. When my supporting elbow fell off the windowsill, I sputtered back to reality and yanked up from a twisted position below the window. My arm hurt, reminding me that even the smallest fall can be dangerous. But at least my crevasse was only a dream. Dr. Zuckerman glared at me and said in a steady tone, "Care to join class, Jerry?" Wincing, I reassumed my stiff, studious posture with note-taking pencil at the ready, as Dr. Zuckerman continued his lecture in his steadily rising classroom tone. He pontificated, "In coloring a geographical map, it is customary to give different colors to any two countries that have common boundaries. It has been found empirically that any map, no matter how many countries it contains, nor how they are situated, can be so colored by using only four different colors. It is easy to see that three will not suffice. Consider the following." As Dr. Zuckerman's now flying fingernails clacked across the board, sending a chalk dust cloud into the room, his pitch went up an octave as he pounced on his punchline. "It has been proven that five colors will suffice for all maps, but it has not been proven that four will likewise suffice." Dr. Zuckerman's copious white hair oscillated with excitement as he did his best to inspire his students to conquer mathematics mountains. This was his Everest. In 1964, the famous four-color problem was one of mathematics' great unsolved problems, having baffled famous mathematicians for 120 years. I had worked on the problem and believed that it would not be solved by an astute proof, but by a computer program requiring many steps and great perseverance. However, my main interest in the problem was not to prove the theorem, but to relate it to the rest of my life. The four-color problem raised many other interesting questions, such as, which colors? When? Why colors? Why the number four? Can you smell a color? If so, what does it smell like? Could I feel it or describe it? I believed that there were always many metaphorical connections between math problems and slices of life. In this case, could I link the four-color problem to my consuming passion, mountains? I already had an A nailed down for this class, which was not bad, since I was sure that my IQ testing fourth grade teacher still considered me an idiot. As Dr. Z, as we called him, lectured in his high-pitched voice, my brain wandered out the window again. Ignoring the squeaky chair, I leaned sideways for a better look. The sky, its usual Seattle gray, seemed lighter, brighter. Somehow I just knew that the sun illuminated a glaciated slope and was beaming on Rainier's summit. The bell ended class precisely as Dr. Z snapped his book shut, but my mind was on top of Rainier. The four-color problem could wait, as Rainier was a mountain worth climbing right now. Walking back to Wilbur's, I stopped at the top of the corridor and stared. The mountain was out, gleaming on the horizon. Mount Rainier, at 14,410 feet, is the highest peak in the Pacific Northwest and impresses all who see it. Unlike Rocky Mountain peaks that rise from high, dry plains, Rainier is a coastal mountain and receives the brunt of the frequent storms that rake the Cascades. Rainier supports three summits over 14,000 feet and 26 named glaciers which plunge over 10,000 feet before spawning the swift, deep rivers surrounding the mountain. If you sliced off Rainier at 13,000 feet, the resulting summit plateau would cover 2 square miles, and refusing such a surgery, this enormous volcano's summit broods in a domain far above the Cascades' lesser peaks. I quickly joined a team of six headed for Rainier, and our goal was simple. We planned to climb the Nisqually Icefall route, traverse over the highest summit, and descend the easier Ingraham Glacier route. The Nisqually Icefall is a slowly cascading jumble of frozen ice blocks that looks like a suspended chaos, and it is one of the more difficult routes on the mountain. I had no trouble convincing my roommate and Denali companion, Dick Springate, to join us. His Cascade experience and gregarious personality always proved invaluable. Tom Stewart came with his strength, experience, and cool head. In a week, Tom and Dick were leaving for Mount Logan, Canada's highest peak, and they were steeling themselves for a big one. Bill Hauser, another Wilburite, brought his keen insights and sharp wit, and Bill was all revved up since he was leaving for Denali in a week. Don Gordon added his bull-like strength, and Herb Staley was an experienced Rainier guide who had climbed the mountain 42 times. On Saturday of Memorial Day weekend, we arrived at Paradise, the traditional starting point on Rainier's south side. Pristine white snowbanks rose 15 feet above the recently plowed parking lot, hemming in both cars and climbers. Next, we checked in with green-collared park rangers who carried out their bizarre ritual of jumping on our ice axes. If an axe broke, its owner could not climb. It was never clear whether this was because the axe would have been too dangerous or simply because you no longer had an axe. One by one, we held our breath as the fierce ranger pounced on our precious wooden axes. Our axes held, and I smiled when the ranger bruised his foot on mine. We shouldered our packs, left civilization's little indignities behind, and started our long trek up to Camp Muir at 10,000 feet. This traditional high camp for summit climbs on the Ingraham Glacier route would be our launching point as well. On our long hike up the Muir snowfields, we met several descending climbers who had failed to reach the summit because of deep snow. But the weather seemed good. In 1964, we did not have detailed satellite-sponsored weather forecasts, and in any case, this was our sacred Memorial Day weekend, so our confidence stayed high. Critical closing colors. A near-black starry sky greeted me when I woke at 2:30 a.m. With youth's enthusiasm surging, I quickly banished sleep to prepare for our big day. I put my lunch into my heavy gray canvas day pack, which was just right for a math major since I had bought it from a friend for $4. Ready, I strapped on my crampons and walked away from Camp Muir on squeaky snow. After a half-mile traverse that took the team to the base of the icefall, still looming unseen in the dark, We crunched up steepening slopes as purple dawn flecked the sky. After the sun found us creeping into the pink-white chaos, the team solved the ice falls problems easily until a steep section threatened to stop us. Dawn did a long lead near the left edge of a huge ice block, and we got around the obstacle. With this difficulty behind us, I felt committed to the upper mountain. The color was pure. By noon, the ice fall was below us and the summit was in sight. However, there was little joy in this fact, since the weather was rapidly deteriorating. Worse, Herb's unexpected poor condition slowed the group to a crawl, but I had no thoughts of turning around to descend the difficult terrain below us. We had to get over the summit and descend the easier route, so we continued nervously upward. When we reached the summit at 3 p.m., visibility dropped, white turned to gray, the wind came up, and it started to snow. We were on Rainier's highest summit, Columbia Crest, which is on the west side of a shallow quarter-mile-wide crater. On the summit, we met Carl and Sally, who had just finished a laborious ascent of the Ingraham Glacier route that we now planned to descend. We joined forces with them since Carl's knowledge of the descent route would be a big help for us, and six strapping lads appearing out of the mist was a happy sight for them. Our summit celebration was brief, and eight strong, we started across the crater floor with Carl and Herb in the lead. With the wind ripping at our backs, we climbed a short rise to the eastern crater rim and dropped onto the mountain's east side. Visibility and color vanished, and I hoped that Carl or Herb could follow the route. At first, we descended rapidly, but our progress soon slowed. With the storm deepening, Carl was having difficulty finding his ascent route, so we held a huddled conference. Herb warned us about crevasses near the 13,000-foot level, and we crept down again as the slope grew steeper. A crevasse appeared off to the right, then another to the left. Finally, a large crevasse appeared below, and we stopped. Carl had not passed through these crevasses on his ascent. We were off route. Like it or not, we could not descend on this line. With eight of us spread out over 200 feet on this steep slope, it was almost impossible to communicate, and because of the crevasses, we couldn't risk getting everyone together for a conference. In any case, this was not a good time for a committee decision. Even though I had never been here before, my sixth sense told me that we were too far north, and I felt that we should retreat back up the slope a short distance, traverse south, then descend again. Communicating my sixth sense to seven strong-willed people spread out on a steep, storm-raked slope high on Rainier was impossible. My nervousness turned to alarm. Critical decisions in the mountains often hinge on a momentary flash of inspiration, but desperation may have motivated ours. From somewhere above, I heard shouted commands that we were going back up to the summit to find a steam cave. Head back up a mountain in a storm? It didn't make sense to me, since I had never heard about caves on Rainier's summit, and even if there were caves, how could we find one in such a storm? As we started back up, the whole tableau felt wrong. In moments of doubt, it is easy to be swayed by action, and I lost myself in the bizarre chore of reclimbing the mountain. With each upward step, I entered a new dimension, as the cold intensified and the day's colors slipped away. Recrossing the eastern crater rim and descending into the volcano's crater, I felt a dark door closing behind me. I didn't know what a steam cave looked like, but I was certainly keen on finding one. No one questioned the insanity of looking for a cave on a high mountain summit in a raging storm at dusk, since we had to find a steam cave or die. After crossing to the base of the final summit slope on the crater's west side, we poked pitifully at the featureless white slope with our ice axes, but found nothing. However, Herb had a nose for sulfur, and he shouted, "I've found one!" We all rushed to the spot to behold our salvation, but my heart sank, since it was nothing more than a small black hole in the snow. Herb's enthusiasm was enormous compared to the opening size, and he dug furiously. Soon he burrowed into the snow like a mole and disappeared. Quizzically, we followed. After wiggling through a 10-foot tunnel, we emerged, to my amazement, into a small, black, windless room. All eight of us crowded into the dank room and stood transformed. A moment earlier, we were fighting for our lives in a desperate whiteout, and now all we heard was our breathing and a dull dripping sound from the cave's blackness. Our binary transition from white to black was like the click of a light switch. Rainier had used two colors. Would it take four or five colors to complete this climb? I knew it couldn't be done with only three, so either way we had at least two colors to go. Our cave was warm. I sank down against the pumice floor and felt the warmth with my bare hands. It was Mother Earth's warmth, and realizing that I was touching an element from one of my least explored domains, I embraced it. With senses slowly returning, we took stock of our position. Rainier is a dormant volcano, but dormant is not the same as extinct. Heat escaping from small steam vents in the summit crater had melted the snow to form our cave, which had a sloping pumice floor and a 6-foot-high snow roof. Sometimes steam caves connect to form long networks of passages under the crater's snow surface. I sensed that this might be a new domain, since within a few feet I synthesized the three parent domains of air, earth, and water. Perhaps there was a fourth parent domain, that of fire. But I was touching that as well. My brain had warned me years ago on the Flatirons that there cannot be synthesis without antithesis, and on this voyage I would finally learn what my brain's warning meant. Tom produced a headlight, and we explored our sanctuary. Still in our crampons, we scratched deeper and discovered that the room was at least 20 feet long. The cave seemed to end there, but a deep black hole disappeared in the back, nearing the dripping sound. There would be time for exploring this unknown passage later. For the moment, we were delighted that there was room for all eight of us. Our desperate gamble had worked. For the first time in several hours, we talked to each other without shouting. We spoke in low tones, since the cave seemed to demand it, and quickly decided that we would spend the night here, since the vehement storm continued outside and we had no choice. With Tom's light reflecting eerily off the snow roof, we settled uncomfortably onto the sloping rust-colored pumice. There was little preparation for the night besides taking off the ropes and our crampons. I rummaged in my gray pack for the remains of my lunch, found a single raisin, and popped it into my mouth. That was dinner. After Tom switched off his light to save the battery, I lay back against the blackness and drifted into an uneasy catharsis. Amazingly, in the middle of the night, my butt got too hot. Some places were warmer than others, so I scooted over a few inches and crammed my trusty canvas pack under me. Listening to the others' breathing, I pondered our problem. My feeling was that we would descend in the morning, but what if the storm continued? A third color clouded my mind, but I pushed it aside, calming myself with my now fervent feeling that we would descend in the morning. I drifted away again. The color of hell. A vague light filtered through the snow, signaling that it was dawn. I sat up and listened, but could not tell if it was sparkling clear or pure hell outside. I needed to go outside to check the weather. While the team's disturbed breathing filled the cave, my stiff muscles creaked across the cave, and I crept into the entry tunnel. As I crawled through, my mind's scientific half knew that the storm could continue for days, but my mind's youthful, optimistic half willed it to be sparkling clear outside, so we could descend in the sun to tell of our grand adventure. I reached the end of the tunnel, pushed away a foot of new snow, and saw the color of hell. Science had made a mockery of my will, but I still couldn't believe it. With the storm lashing at my eyes, I optimistically thought that I might just be in some surface spindrift. So I wiggled farther out to be sure. My will was nowhere in sight. It was indeed hell outside. If anything, the storm was wilder than yesterday. To make matters worse, my clothing held a lot of moisture from the warm cave, and now, with the wind blasting on my parka, I felt an instant deep cold. Aided by wind and moisture, the cold penetrated fast, as a pang of red-hot fear stabbed deep inside me. There was a third color, and it was the color of hell. This was not just a painting of hell. This was a gushing, gurgling, sighing, dying, red, white, black, hot, cold hell. Answer in hand, I wiggled back into the cave sanctuary and gasped, "It's hell out there. Go see for yourselves." The rest of the team stirred, and several of them ventured into the entry tunnel. They all returned, adding their own adjectives, but confirming my observations, and ours quickly became a fear-filled, hoary hell. I rummaged again in the remains of my lunch, and this time found nothing. That was breakfast. With hell's murky half-light filtering into the cave, a long discussion followed, and our voices were now quite animated, since we had much to talk about. We were safe in the cave for the moment, but we were still on Rainier's summit in a storm. We had no way of knowing how long the storm might last, but knew that it could go on for days. It kept us alive, but it also kept us wet. If we decided to wait in the cave and the storm lasted for days, we would be very weak and wet when we finally descended. If we attempted to descend right now, we would be stronger but must face the storm. We had attempted the descent yesterday and had failed. We were now in worse condition for our effort. Drawing on Herb's detailed Rainier knowledge, we debated alternative descent routes, but none of them solved our basic problem, which is that we remained trapped on Rainier's summit in a raging storm. Occasionally a temper flared, but these outbursts came from fear, and our large group's calming effect minimized machismo. For the most part, our conversation was very analytical, and I wondered what Dr. Z would do to solve this problem. Doubtless he would just scratch his talon fingernails on the board and come up with a brilliant, colorful conclusion. After several hours of intense debate, we decided to go for it and attempt the descent right now. It was a difficult decision, but in the end, we felt that action was preferable to inaction and voted for strength over patience. We worked out a detailed plan, since once in the wind we would not be able to communicate. If our plan worked, we would be off this hellish mountain in a few hours. As a backup, if conditions became too difficult, we could abandon the attempt and return to the cave like yesterday. We completed our preparations in a few minutes, since all we had to do was strap on our crampons, collect the ropes, and crawl out of the cave. We knew that it was going to be tough and steeled ourselves for the wind's frigid blast. We had difficulty with the icy ropes, but soon started across the crater. Herb had the most intimate knowledge of Rainier, so he led, while Don, Dick, and I followed him as a rope of four. With the wind blasting on our backs, the other four followed on a second rope. The motion felt good to my stiff muscles, and I was just starting to generate some heat when the rope stopped. Herb's crampons had come off, so Don and Dick moved up to help him get them back on, since they would be essential once we left the crater and started the steep descent. The rest of us just stood with our backs to the wind and endured the tempest. After 5 long minutes, I became impatient and advanced to Herb. His crampons were back on, but he was crouching in the snow trying to talk with Don and Dick. We had already had our conversation, and shivering badly, I knew that we had to move fast, so I motioned to Herb to get going. Herb got to his feet and moved forward again, but only went another rope length. From my position at the end of the rope, I watched Herb wandering into the whiteout. It was important that we cross the eastern crater rim in exactly the right place, because on a symmetric volcano like Rainier, a small directional error descending from the summit would magnify to put us on a completely different route lower down. We had a compass, but couldn't use it in the howling wind. Finally, Herb struggled back to Don. It was no good. We couldn't even find our way across the crater, much less descend the entire mountain. We would freeze if we didn't get back to the cave fast. So we turned into the wind, bowed our heads to the tempest, and struggled back. When we reached the cave's vicinity, we could not find it. The cave had vanished. We didn't need to talk, since we all knew what to do. Still roped up, we spread out and started probing and digging. After many finger-freezing minutes, Bill found the entrance, wiggled in, and pulled the rest of us in on the ropes like a catch of fish. We shivered and fumbled badly for a long time in our black sanctuary. Our gamble had failed, and our penalty was reduced strength and another night in the cave, but at least we were still alive. The cave was quiet, but it now smelled like hell, and this was the first time that I had ever smelled a color. It was a combination of sulfur, snow, sweat, shit, and fear. The prospect of spending another night slithering down the sloping cave floor was grim. So after testing the slope with an ice axe, we hacked away at the wretched, friable pumice and slowly created a crude platform. The activity warmed and jazzed us, since at least we were doing something. After a debate, we decided not to toss the debris into the black hole at the back of the cave. The hole appeared useless and was dangerous, but we were leery of losing any possible advantage, since we might still need the hole. Dick, Bill, and I hunkered on our new pumice platform, while Carl and Sally clung to each other near the tunnel entrance, trying to breathe non-existent fresh air. In the back of the cave, Don, Herb, and Tom settled painfully above the black hole. We didn't have the energy to be hungry, and the light faded along with our conversation, since we had little left to talk about. Perhaps my willpower was feeble compared to the storm, but it couldn't hurt to try, so I willed that it would clear tomorrow, and that we would descend. The already dim light faded to black, then each of us faded into our own private stupors. At first, the heat felt good, but after thrashing around for a half hour, I realized that my butt was too hot. When we cut into the slope, we had increased the size of the tiny steam vents, and they now created a new and unexpected hazard, burns. After locating the worst vents and avoiding them, I folded my canvas pack twice and perched on it. As the steam, sulfur, and pumice ground into it, the smell of the color of hell infused my pack's canvas until the canvas became the smell and color. Now I smelled a fourth color. We roasted on the bottom and froze on top. Somewhere in the night's nadir, I heard Sally's sobbing voice. "Ow! I'm burning! Oh! I'm freezing! Oh! Ow! Oh! Ow!" It was miserable. As a thin snow film settled on us, melted into our clothing, and kept us soaking wet. I heard dripping from new parts of the cave, and poked a finger into the now sodden snow roof. The blackness enveloped me, and I patiently perched, since this was not a time for brilliant solutions. This was a time for perseverance. My brain voice was groggy as well, but did manage to remind me that here, on a steep, high, snowy volcano, I had my best opportunity for karmic gain. At the time, this thought only seemed like a taunt, but as usual, my brain was ahead of the moment. After slowing my breathing, I gradually fell away into convoluted four-color dreams. Stay tuned for the conclusion of Das Cave in the next episode.